In the Woods, Disc 7.
All that was on the Monday, almost a week after Katie had died. In that week, neither Jonathan nor Margaret Devlin had phoned us to ask how the investigation was going. I wasn't complaining exactly. Some families ring 4 or 5 times a day, desperate for answers. And there are few things more excruciating than telling them we have none. But all the same, it was another small, unsettling thing in a case that was already much too full of them. Rosalind finally came in on Tuesday, at lunchtime. No phone call, no arrangement, just Bernadette informing me with faint disapproval that there was a young woman to see me. But I knew it was her. And the fact that she had shown up out of the blue like that smacked of desperation somehow, of some clandestine urgency. I dropped what I was doing and went downstairs, ignoring the inquiring raised eyebrows from Cassie and Sam. Rosalind was waiting in reception. She had an emerald shawl wrapped tightly around her. Her face, turned to look out the window, was wistful and far away. She was too young to know it, but she made a lovely picture. The fall of chestnut curls and the splash of green poised against the sunlit brick and stone of the courtyard. Block out the defiantly utilitarian lobby, and the scene could have come straight off a pre-Raphaelite greeting card. "Rosalind," I said. She spun from the window, a hand going to her chest.
"Oh, Detective Ryan, you startled me. Thank you so much for seeing me."
"Any time," I said. "Come upstairs and we'll talk."
"Are you sure? I don't want to be any trouble. If you're too busy, just tell me and I'll go."
"You're no trouble at all. Can I get you a cup of tea? Coffee?"
"Coffee would be lovely. But do we have to go in there? It's such a lovely day, and I'm a little claustrophobic. I don't like to tell people, but couldn't we go outside?"
It wasn't standard procedure, but then I reasoned she wasn't a suspect or even necessarily a witness. "Sure," I said. "Just give me a second." And ran upstairs for the coffee. I'd forgotten to ask her how she took it, so I added a little milk and put 2 sachets of sugar in my pocket in case. "Here you go," I said to Rosalind downstairs. "Shall we find somewhere in the garden?" She took a sip of coffee and tried to hide a quick little moo of distaste. "I know, it's foul," I said.
"No, no, that's fine. It's just that, well, I don't take milk, usually, but..."
"Oops," I said. "Sorry about that. Want me to get you another one?"
"Oh, no, it's all right, Detective Ryan. Honestly, I didn't really need coffee. You have this one. I don't want to put you to any trouble. It's wonderful of you to see me. You mustn't go out of your way..."
She was talking too fast, too high and chatty, hands flying, and she held my eyes for too long without blinking, as if she had been hypnotized. She was badly nervous and trying hard to cover up. "It's no problem at all," I said gently. "I'll tell you what, let's find somewhere nice to sit, and then I'll get you another cup of coffee. It'll still be foul, but at least it'll be black. How does that sound?"
Rosalind smiled up at me gratefully,
and for a moment I had a startled sense that this small act of consideration had moved her almost to tears. We found a bench in the gardens, in the sun. Birds were twittering and rustling in the hedges, darting out to wrestle with discarded sandwich crusts. I left Rosalind there and went back up for the coffee. I took my time to give her a chance to settle down, but when I got back, she was still sitting on the edge of the bench, biting her lip and picking the petals off a daisy.
"Thank you,"
she said, taking the coffee and trying to smile. I sat down beside her.
"Detective Ryan, have you found out who killed my sister?"
"Not yet," I said. "But it's early days. I promise you, we're doing absolutely everything we can."
"I know you'll catch him, Detective Ryan. I knew the minute I saw you. I can tell an awful lot about people from first impressions. Sometimes it actually scares me how often I'm right, and I knew right away that you were the person we needed."
She was looking up at me with pure, unblemished faith in her eyes. I was flattered, of course I was. But at the same time, this level of trust made me very uncomfortable. She was so sure and so desperately vulnerable. And although you try not to think this way, I knew there was a chance this case would never be solved. And I knew exactly what that would do to her.
"I had a dream about you," Rosalind said, then glanced down embarrassed. "The night after Katie's funeral. I hadn't slept more than an hour a night since she vanished, you know. I was frantic. But seeing you that day, it reminded me not to give up. That night I dreamed you knocked on our door and told me you caught the man who did this. You had him in the police car behind you and you said he'd never hurt anyone again."
"Rosalind," I said, "I couldn't take this. We're doing our best and we won't give up. But you have to prepare yourself for the possibility that it might take a very long time." She shook her head.
"You'll find him,"
she said simply. I let it go. "You said there was something you wanted to ask me?"
"Yes."
She took a deep breath.
"What happened to my sister, Detective Ryan?" "Exactly."
Her eyes were wide and intent, and I wasn't sure how to handle this. If I told her, would she break down, collapse, scream? The gardens were full of chattery office workers on their lunch break. "I should really let your parents tell you about it," I said.
"I'm 18, you know. You don't need their permission to talk to me."
"Still." Rosalind bit her bottom lip.
"I asked them. They told me to shut up."
Something zipped through me. Anger, alarm bells, compassion, I'm not sure. "Rosalind," I said very gently, "is everything all right at home?" Her head flew up, mouth open in a little O.
"Yes,"
she said in a small, uncertain voice.
"Of course."
"Are you sure?"
"You're very kind," she said shakily. "You're so good to me, everything's fine."
"Would you be more comfortable talking to my partner?"
"No,"
she said sharply, and with what sounded like disapproval in her voice.
"I wanted to talk to you because..."
She turned the cup in circles in her lap.
"I felt like you cared, Detective Ryan. About Katie. Your partner didn't really seem to care, but you're different."
"Of course we both care," I said. I wanted to put a reassuring arm around her, or a hand on hers or something, but I've never been good at that stuff.
"Oh, I know. But your partner..."
She gave me a self-deprecating little smile.
"I guess I'm a bit scared of her. She's so aggressive."
"My partner?" I said, startled. "Detective Maddox?" Cassie has always been the one with the reputation for being good with the families. I get stiff and tongue-tied, but she always seems to know the right thing to say and the gentlest way to say it. Some families still send her sad, valiant, grateful little cards at Christmas. Rosalind's hands fluttered helplessly.
"Oh, Detective Ryan, I don't mean it in a bad way. Being aggressive is a good thing, isn't it? Especially in your job. And I'm probably much too sensitive. It was just how she went on at my parents. I know she had to ask all those questions, but it was the way she asked them so coldly. Jessica was really upset. And she was smiling at me like it was all... Katie's death wasn't a joke, Detective Ryan."
"Very far from it," I said. I was mentally skimming through that awful session in the Devlin's sitting room, trying to work out what the hell Cassie had done to get this kid so upset. The only thing I could think of was that she'd given Rosalind an encouraging smile when she sat her down on the sofa. In retrospect, I supposed that could have been a little inappropriate, although hardly enough to warrant this kind of reaction. Shock and grief often do make people overreact in skewed, illogical ways, but still, this level of jumpiness strengthened my feeling that there was something up in that house. I'm sorry if we gave the impression.
No, oh no, not you. You were wonderful. And I know Detective Maddox can't have meant to seem so... so harsh. Really, I do. Most aggressive people are just trying to be strong, aren't they? They just don't want to be insecure or needy or anything like that. They're not actually cruel underneath.
No, I said. Probably not. I had a hard time thinking of Cassie as needy. But then I had never thought of her as aggressive either. I realized with a sudden small shot of unease that I had no way of knowing how Cassie came across to other people. It was like trying to tell whether your sister is pretty or something. I could no more be objective about her than about myself.
Have I offended you?
Rosalind looked up at me nervously, pulling at her ringlet.
I have. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm always putting my foot in it. I open my silly mouth and everything just comes out, I never learn.
No, I said. It's fine. I'm not offended at all.
You are? I can tell.
She threw her shawl more closely around her shoulders and flipped her hair out from under it, her face tight and withdrawn. I knew if I lost her now, I might never have another chance. Honestly, I said, I'm not. I was just thinking about what you said. It's very insightful. She played with the fringe of the shawl, not meeting my eyes.
But isn't she your girlfriend?
Detective Maddox? No, 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 I said. Nothing like that.
But I thought from the way she...
She clapped a hand over her mouth.
Oh, there I go again. Stop, Rosalind.
I laughed. I couldn't help it. We were both trying so hard. Come on, I said. Take a deep breath and we'll start over. Slowly she relaxed back onto the bench.
Thank you, Detective Ryan. But please, just what exactly happened to Katie? I keep imagining, you see. I can't bear not knowing.
And so, because what could I say to that, I told her. She didn't faint or go into hysterics, or even burst into tears. She listened in silence, with her eyes, blue eyes, the colour of faded denim, fixed on mine. When I'd finished, she put her fingers to her lips and stared out into the sunshine at the neat patterns of hedges, the office workers with their plastic containers and gossip. I patted her shoulder awkwardly. The shawl was cheap stuff once you touched it, prickly and synthetic, and the childish, pathetic gallantry of it went to my heart. I wanted to say something to her, something wise and profound about how few deaths can match the refined agony of being the one left behind. Something that she could remember when she was alone and sleepless and uncomprehending in her room. But I couldn't find the words. I'm so sorry, I said.
So she wasn't raped?
There was a flat, hollow note in her voice. Drink your coffee, I said, with some obscure notion about hot drinks being good for shock.
No, no, she waved her hand distractedly. Tell me, she wasn't raped?
Not exactly, no. And she was already dead, you know. She didn't feel a thing.
She didn't suffer much?
Hardly at all. She was knocked out almost immediately. Suddenly Rosalind bent her head over the coffee cup, and I saw her lips quivering.
I feel awful about it, Detective Ryan. I feel as if I should have protected her better.
You didn't know.
But I should have known. I should have been there, not having fun with my cousins. I'm a terrible sister, aren't I?
You are not responsible for Katie's death, I said firmly. It sounds to me as though you were a wonderful sister to her. There's nothing you could have done.
But...
She stopped, shook her head. But what?
Oh, I should have known. That's all. Never mind.
She smiled tentatively up at me through her hair.
Thank you for telling me.
My turn, I said. Can I ask you a couple of things? She looked apprehensive, but she took a deep breath and nodded. Your father said Katie wasn't into boys yet, I said. Is that true?
Her mouth opened, then closed again. I don't know,
she said in a small voice. Rosalind, I know this isn't easy for you, but if she was, we need to know.
Katie was my sister, Detective Ryan. I don't want to say things about her.
I know, I said gently. But the best thing you can do for her now is to tell me anything that might help me find her killer. Finally she sighed, a tremulous little breath.
Yes, she said. She liked boys. I don't know who exactly, but I heard her and her friends teasing each other about boyfriends, you know, and who they'd kissed.
The thought of 12-year-olds kissing startled me. But I remembered Katie's friends, those knowing, disconcerting little girls. Maybe Peter and Jamie and I had just been backwards. Are you positive? Your father seemed pretty sure.
My father...
There was a tiny frown line between Rosalind's eyebrows.
My father worshipped Katie. And she... Sometimes she took advantage of that. She didn't always tell the truth. That made me very sad.
Okay, I said. Okay, I understand. You've done the right thing by telling me. She nodded, just a slight inclination of the head. I need to ask you one more thing. You ran away from home in May, right? The frown deepened.
I didn't exactly run away, Detective Ryan. I'm not a child. I spent a weekend with a friend.
Who was that?
Karen Daly. You can ask her if you'd like. I'll give you her number.
There's no need, I said, ambiguously. We had already talked to Karen, a timid, pasty-faced girl, not at all what I would have expected a friend of Rosalind's to be. And she had confirmed that Rosalind had been with her all weekend. But I have a fairly good nose for deception, and I was pretty sure there was something Karen wasn't telling me. Your cousin thought you might have spent the weekend with a boyfriend. Rosalind's mouth tightened into a displeased little line.
Valerie has a dirty mind. I know a lot of other girls do things like that, but I'm not other girls.
No, I said, you're not. But your parents didn't know where you were?
No, they didn't.
Why was that?
Because I didn't feel like telling them,
she said sharply. Then she glanced up at me and sighed, and her face softened.
Oh, Detective, don't you ever feel that you just need to get away from everything, that it's all just too much?
I do, I said. Yes. So the weekend away wasn't because anything bad had happened at home? We've been told you had a fight with your father. Rosalind's face clouded over and she looked away. I waited. After a moment she shook her head.
No. Nothing like that.
My alarm bells were going off again, but her voice had tightened, and I didn't want to push her, not yet. I wonder now, of course, whether I should have. But I can't see that, in the long run, it would have made any difference to anything at all. I know you're having a very hard time right now, I said. But don't run away again, okay? If things are getting on top of you, or if you just want to talk, give Victim Support a ring. Or call me. You have my mobile number, right? I'll do whatever I can to help.
Rosalind nodded. Thank you, Detective Ryan. I'll remember that.
but her face was withdrawn, subdued, and I had the sense that, in some obscure but critical way, I had let her down. Cassie was in the squad room, photocopying statements.
"Who was that?"
"Rosalind Devlin."
"Huh,"
Cassie said.
"What did she say?"
For some reason, I didn't feel like telling her the details.
"Nothing much. Just that, no matter what Jonathan thought, Katie was into boys. Rosalind didn't know any names. We'll need to talk to Katie's mates again and see if they can give us more." She also said Katie told lies, but then most kids do.
"Anything else?"
"Not really."
Cassie turned from the photocopier, a page in her hand, and gave me a long look I couldn't read. Then she said,
"At least she's talking to you. You should stay in touch with her.
She might open up more as you go."
"I did ask her whether there was anything wrong at home," I said, a little guiltily. "She said no, but I didn't believe her."
"Hmm," Cassie said, and went back to photocopying. But when we talked to Christina and Marianne and Beth again the next day, they were all adamant. Katie had had no boyfriends and no particular crushes.
"We used to tease her about guys sometimes," Beth said, "but not really, you know, just messing."
She was a red-headed, cheerful-looking kid, already sprouting boisterous curves, and when her eyes filled with tears, she seemed bewildered by them, as if crying was still an unfamiliar thing. She fished in the sleeve of her sweater and pulled out a tattered tissue.
"She might not have told us, though," said Marianne.
She was the quietest of the bunch, a pale fairy of a girl vanishing into her funky teenage clothes.
Katie was very private about stuff. Like the first time she auditioned for ballet school, we didn't even know about it till she got accepted, remember?"
Hello, not the same thing," Christina said.
But she had been crying too, and the stuffed nose took most of the authority off her voice.
"We couldn't exactly have missed a boyfriend."
The floaters would re-interview every boy on the estate and in Katie's class, of course, just in case. But I realised that at some level this was exactly what I had been expecting. This case was like an endless, infuriating street-corner shell game. I knew the prize was in there somewhere, right under my eye. But the game was rigged, and the dealer much too fast for me. And every sure thing shell I turned over came up empty. Sophie rang me as we were leaving Knocknaree to say that the lab results were back. She was walking somewhere. I could hear the mobile jolting and the fast, decisive taps of her shoes.
"I've got your results on the Devlin kid," she said. "The lab's got a 6-week backlog, and you know what they're like, but I got them to jump this one up the queue. I practically had to sleep with the head geek before he'd do it."
My heart rate picked up. "Bless you, Sophie," I said. "We owe you another one." Cassie, driving, glanced across at me. I mouthed, "Results."
"Tox screen was negative. She wasn't drugged, drunk, or on any medication. She was covered in trace. Mostly outdoor stuff, dirt, pollen, the usual. It's all consistent with the soil composition around Knocknaree. Even..."
This is the good part.
"Even the stuff that was inside her clothes and stuck to the blood. So, stuff she didn't just pick up at the dump site. Lab says there's some super rare plant in that wood that doesn't grow anywhere else nearby. It got the plant geek very turned on, apparently, and the pollen wouldn't blow more than a mile or so. The odds are she was in Knocknaree the whole time."
"That fits with what we have," I said. "Get to the good stuff." Sophie snorted.
"That was the good stuff. The footprints are a dead end. Half of them match the archaeologists, and the ones that don't are too blurry to be any use. Practically all the fibres are consistent with stuff we pulled from the home. A handful of unidentified ones, but
Nothing distinctive. One hair on the T-shirt matching the idiot who found her, two that matched the mother. One on the combats, one on a sock. And she probably does the washing, so no big deal there.
Any DNA? Or fingerprints or anything?
Ha!
Sophie said. She was eating something crunchy, probably crisps. Sophie lives mainly on junk food.
A few bloody partials, but they came off a rubber glove, surprise, surprise. So, no epithelials either, and no semen and no saliva and no blood that doesn't match the kid.
Great, I said, my heart slowly sinking. I had fallen for the con all over again. I'd got my hopes up and I felt suckered and stupid.
Except for that old spot Helen found. They got a blood type off it. It's A positive. Your victim's O neg.
She paused for another mouthful of crisps while my stomach did something complicated.
What?
She demanded, when I said nothing.
That's what you wanted to hear, isn't it? Same as the blood from the old case? OK, so it's tentative, but at least it's a link.
Yeah, I said. I could feel Cassie listening. I turned my shoulder to her.
That's great. Thanks, Sophie. We've sent the swabs and those shoes off for DNA testing, Sophie said, but I wouldn't hold your breath if I were you. I bet it's all degraded to fuck. Who stores blood evidence in a basement?
Cassie, by unspoken agreement, was following up on the old case while I concentrated on the Devlins. McCabe had died several years before, a heart attack, but she went to see Kiernan. He was retired and living in Laytown, a little commuter village up along the coast. He was well into his 70s, with a ruddy, good-humoured face and the comfortably sloppy build of a rugby player gone to seed. But he brought Cassie for a long walk on the wide, empty beach, seagulls and curlews screaming while he told her what he remembered about the Knocknaree case. He seemed happy, Cassie said that evening, as she lit the fire and I spread mustard on ciabatta rolls and Sam poured the wine. He had taken up woodworking. There was sawdust on his soft-worn trousers. His wife had wrapped a scarf around his neck and kissed his cheek as he went out. He remembered the case, though, in every detail. In all Ireland's brief disorganized history as a nation, fewer than half a dozen children have gone missing and stayed that way, and Kiernan had never been able to forget that two of these had been given into his hands, and he had failed them. The search, he told Cassie, a little defensively, she said, as though this was a conversation he'd had many times in his mind, had been massive. Dogs, helicopters, divers. Policemen and volunteers had combed miles of wood and hill and field in every direction, starting at dawn every morning for weeks, and going on into the late summer twilights. They had followed leads to Belfast and Kerry and even Birmingham. And all the time a nagging whisper had insisted in Kiernan's ear that they were looking in the wrong directions, that the answer was right in front of them all along.
"What's his theory?" Sam asked.
I flipped the last steak onto its roll and handed round the plates.
"Later," Cassie said to Sam. "Enjoy your sandwich first. How often does Ryan do something that's worth appreciating?"
"You are speaking to two talented men here," I told her. "We can eat and listen at the same time."
It would have been nice to hear this story in private first, obviously, but by the time Cassie had got back from Laytown, it had been too late for that. The thought had already killed my appetite. The thing itself wasn't going to make much difference. Besides, we always talked about the case over dinner, and today was not going to be any different if I could help it. Sam appears blithely unaware of subtext and emotional cross-currents, but I sometimes wonder if anyone can be quite as oblivious as all that.
"I'm impressed," Cassie said. "Okay,"
her eyes went to me for a second. I looked away.
"Kiernan's theory was that the kids never left Knocknaree. I don't know if you guys remember this, but there was a third kid."
She leaned sideways to check her notebook, open on the arm of the sofa.
"Adam Ryan.
He was with the other two that afternoon and they found him in the wood a couple of hours into the search. No injuries, but there was blood in his shoes and he was pretty shaken up. He couldn't remember anything.
So Kiernan figured that whatever happened, it must have been either in the wood or very nearby. Otherwise, how had Adam got back there?
He thought someone local, had been watching them for a while. The guy approached them in the wood, maybe lured them back to his house and attacked them. Probably he hadn't planned to kill them. Maybe he tried to molest them and something went wrong. At some point during the attack, Adam escaped and ran back into the wood, which probably means they were either in the wood itself, in one of the estate houses that back onto it, or in one of the farmhouses nearby. Otherwise, he'd have gone home, right?
Kiernan thinks the guy panicked and killed the other two children, possibly stashed the bodies in his house until he saw his chance, and then either dumped them in the river or buried them in his garden, or, more likely, there were no reports of unexplained digging in the area over the next few weeks, in the wood. I took a bite of my sandwich. The taste, pungent and bloody, almost made me retch. I forced it down, unchewed, with a swallow of wine. "Where's young Adam these days?" Sam inquired. Cassie shrugged.
"I doubt he'd be able to tell us anything. Kiernan and McCabe kept going back to him for years, but he never remembered any more. In the end they gave up, figured the memory was gone for good. The family moved out of the area. Knocknaree gossip says they emigrated to Canada."
All of which was true, as far as it went. This was both more difficult and more ridiculous than I'd expected. We were like spies, communicating over Sam's head in careful, stilted code.
"They must have been going mental," Sam said. "An eyewitness right there."
He shook his head and took a big bite of sandwich.
"Yeah, Kiernan said it was frustrating, all right," Cassie said. "But the kid was doing his best. He even participated in a reconstruction with two local kids. They were hoping it would help him remember what he and his mates had done that afternoon, but he froze up as soon as he got into the wood."
My stomach flipped. I had no memory of this at all. I put down my sandwich. Suddenly and intensely, I wanted a cigarette.
"Poor little bastard," Sam said peacefully.
"Was this what McCabe thought too?" I asked.
"No," Cassie licked mustard off her thumb. "McCabe thought it was a tourist killer. Some guy who was only here for a few days, probably over from England, maybe for work. See, they couldn't find a single good suspect. They did almost 1,000 questionnaires, hundreds of interviews. Ruled out all the known perverts and weirdos in South Dublin. Accounted for every local man's movements down to the minute. You know what it's like. You almost always come up with a suspect, even if you don't have enough to charge him. They had nobody. Every time they got a lead, they ran bang into a dead end."
"That sounds familiar," I said grimly.
"Kiernan thinks it was because someone gave the guy a fake alibi, so he never really made it onto their radar, but McCabe figured it was because he wasn't there to find. His theory was that the kids were playing by the river and followed it to where it comes out on the other side of the wood. It's a long walk, but they'd done it before. There's a little back road that goes right past that stretch of the river. McCabe thought someone was driving by, saw the kids and tried to drag them or lure them into his car. Adam fought, got away and ran back into the wood, and the guy drove off with the other two. McCabe talked to Interpol and the British police, but they didn't come up with anything useful."
"Kiernan and McCabe," I said, "both thought the children were murdered then."
"McCabe wasn't sure, apparently. He thought there was a chance someone had abducted them. Maybe someone mentally ill and desperate to have kids. Or maybe..."
"Well, At first they thought they might have just run away, but 2 12-year-olds with no money. They'd have been found within days.
Well, Katie was no random tourist killing, Sam said. He had to set up the meeting, keep her somewhere for the day.
Actually, I said, impressed by the pleasant, everyday tone of my voice, I can't really see the old case as a car snatch either. As far as I remember, the shoes were only put back on the kid after the blood in them had started to congeal. In other words, the abductor spent some time with all three of them in the area before one got away. To me, that says local.
Knocknaree's a small place, Sam said. What are the odds of 2 different child murderers living there?
Cassie balanced her plate on her crossed legs, linked her hands behind her neck, and arched stiffness out of it. There were dark shadows under her eyes. I realized suddenly that her afternoon with Kiernan had hit her hard, and that her reluctance to tell the story might not have been just for my sake.
There's a specific tiny compression to the corners of her mouth when she's holding something back, and I wonder what Kiernan had told her that she wasn't saying.
They even searched the trees, you know that, she said. After a few weeks, some smart floater remembered an old case where a kid climbed a hollow tree and fell into a hole in the trunk. He wasn't found till 40 years later. Kiernan and McCabe had people checking every tree, shining torches into hollows.
Her voice drifted off, and we fell silent. Sam munched his sandwich with even, unhurried appreciation, put down the plate, and sighed contentedly. Finally, Cassie stirred, held out a hand. I put her smoke packet into it.
Kiernan still dreams about it, you know,
she said quietly, fishing out a cigarette.
Not as much as he used to, he said. Only every few months since he retired. He dreams that he's searching for the 2 kids in the wood at night, calling them, and someone leaps out of the bushes and rushes at him. He knows it's the person who took them. He can see his face, clear as I see you, he said. But when he wakes up, he can't remember it.
The fire cracked and spat sharply. I caught it out of the corner of my eye and whipped round. I was sure I had seen something shoot out of the fireplace into the room. Some small, black, clawed thing. Baby bird, maybe, falling down the chimney. But there was nothing there. When I turned back, Sam's eyes were on me, grey and calm and somehow sympathetic. But he only smiled and leaned across the table to refill my glass. I was having trouble sleeping, even when I got the opportunity. I often do, as I've said, but this was different. In those weeks, I kept finding myself trapped in some twilight zone between sleep and waking, unable to force my way into either.
Look out!
Voices said suddenly and loudly in my ear, or,
I can't hear you.
What?
What?
I half-dreamed dark intruders moving stealthily around the room, riffling through my work notes and fingering the shirts in my wardrobe. I knew they couldn't be real, but it took me a panicky eternity to drag myself awake to either confront or dispel them. Once I woke to find myself slumped against the wall by my bedroom door, pawing crazily at the light switch, my legs barely able to hold me up. My head was swimming, and there was a muffled moaning sound coming from somewhere, and it was a long time before I realized that it was my voice. I turned on the light and my desk lamp and crawled back into bed where I lay, too shaken to go back to sleep, until my alarm went off. In this limbo, I kept hearing children's voices too. Not Peter's and Jamie's or anything. This was a group of children a long way off, chanting playground rhymes that I didn't remember ever having known. Their voices were gay and uncaring and too pure to be human. And underneath them were the brisk, expert rhythms of complicated hand clapping. Say, my playmate, come out and play with me. Climb up my apple tree. Two, the lily-white boys, clothed all in greeno. One is one, and all alone, and evermore shall be so. Sometimes their faint chorus stayed in my head all day, a high, inescapable underscore to whatever I was doing. I lived in mortal dread that O'Kelly would catch me humming one of the rhymes. Rosalind phoned my mobile that Saturday. I was in the incident room. Cassie had gone off to talk to missing persons. Behind me, O'Gorman was bellowing about some guy who'd failed to give him proper respect during the door-to-door. I had to press for the phone to my ear to hear her.
"Detective Ryan, it's Rosalind. I'm so sorry to bother you, but do you think you might have the time to come talk to Jessica?"
City noises in the background, cars, loud conversation, the frenetic beeping of a pedestrian signal. "Of course," I said. "Where are you?"
"We're in town. Could we meet you in the Central Hotel bar in, say, 10 minutes? Jessica has something to tell you."
I dug out the main file and started flipping through it for Rosalind's date of birth. If I was going to talk to Jessica, I needed an appropriate adult present.
"Are your parents with you?"
No, I think Jessica might be more comfortable talking without them, if that's all right."
My antenna prickled. I'd found the page of family stats. Rosalind was 18 and appropriate, as far as I was concerned.
"No problem," I said. "I'll see you there."
"Thank you, Detective Ryan. I knew I could come to you. I'm sorry to rush you, but we really should get home before..."
A beep, and she was gone. Either her battery or her credit had run out. I wrote Cassie a back soon note and left. Rosalind had good taste. The Central Bar has a stubbornly old-fashioned feel. Ceiling mouldings, huge comfortable armchairs taking up inefficient quantities of space, shelves of weird old books in elegant bindings. That contrasts satisfyingly with the manic overdrive of the streets below. Sometimes I used to go there on Saturdays, have a glass of brandy and a cigar — this was before the smoking ban — and spend the afternoon reading the 1938 Farmer's Almanac, or third-rate Victorian poems. Rosalind and Jessica were at a table by the window. Rosalind's curls were caught up loosely, and she was wearing a white outfit, long skirt and gauzy ruffled blouse that blended perfectly with the surroundings. She looked as if she'd just stepped in from some Edwardian garden party. She was leaning over to whisper in Jessica's ear, one hand stroking her hair in a slow, soothing rhythm. Jessica was in an armchair, her legs curled under her, and the sight of her hit me all over again almost as hard as it had that first time. The sun streaming through the high window held her in a column of light that transformed her into a radiant vision of someone else. Someone vivid and eager and lost. The fine crooked V's of her eyebrows, the tilt of her nose, the full childish curve of her lip. The last time I'd looked into that face, it had been empty and blood-smeared on Cooper's steel table. She was like a reprieve, like Eurydice, gifted back to Orpheus from the darkness for a brief, miraculous moment. I wanted so intensely it took my breath away to reach out and lay a hand on her soft, dark head, to pull her tightly against me, and feel her slight and warm and breathing, as if by protecting her hard enough I could somehow undo time and protect Katie too. "Rosalind," I said. "Jessica." Jessica flinched, eyes widening sharply, and the illusion was gone. She was holding something, a packet of sugar from the bowl in the middle of the table. She shoved the corner into her mouth and started to suck on it. Rosalind's face lit up at the sight of me.
"Detective Ryan! It's so good to see you. I know it was short notice, but, oh, sit down, sit down."
I pulled up another armchair.
"Jessica saw something I think you should know about, didn't you, pet?"
Jessica shrugged, an awkward wriggle.
"Hi, Jessica,"
I said softly and as calmly as I could. My mind was shooting in a dozen directions at once. If this had anything to do with the parents, then I would have to find somewhere for the girls to go, and Jessica was going to be terrible on the stand.
"I'm glad you decided to tell me. What did you see?"
Her lips parted. She swayed a little in her chair. Then she shook her head.
"Oh, dear. I thought this might happen," Rosalind sighed. "Well, she told me that she saw Katie..."
"Thanks, Rosalind," I said. "But I really need to hear this from Jessica. Otherwise it's hearsay, and that's not admissible in court." Rosalind stared blankly, taken aback. Finally, she nodded.
"Well," she said, "of course, if that's what you need, then I just hope..."
She bent over Jessica and tried to catch her eyes, smiling. Hooked her hair back behind her ear.
"Jessica, darling, you really need to tell Detective Ryan what we talked about, sweetheart. It's important."
Jessica ducked her head away.
"Don't remember," she whispered.
Rosalind's smile tightened.
"Come on, Jessica. You remembered just fine earlier on, before we came all the way out here and dragged Detective Ryan away from work. Didn't you?"
Jessica shook her head again and bit down on the sugar packet. Her lip was trembling. "It's all right," I said. I wanted to shake her. "She's just a little nervous. She's been having a hard time. Right, Jessica?"
"We've both been having a hard time," Rosalind said sharply. "But one of us has to act like an adult instead of like a stupid little girl."
Jessica shrank deeper into her oversized sweater. "I know," I said, in what I hoped was a soothing tone. "I know. I understand how hard this is."
"No, actually, Detective Ryan, you don't."
Rosalind's crossed knee was jiggling angrily.
"Nobody can possibly understand what this is like. I don't know why we came in. Jessica can't be bothered to tell you what she saw, and you obviously don't think that matters. We might as well go."
I couldn't lose them. "Rosalind," I said urgently, leaning forward across the table, "I'm taking this very seriously. And I do understand. Honestly, I do." Rosalind laughed bitterly, fumbling under the table for her purse.
"Oh, I'm sure. Put that thing down, Jessica. We're going home."
"Rosalind, I do. When I was about Jessica's age, two of my best friends disappeared. I know what you're going through." Her head came up and she stared at me. "I know it's not the same as losing a sister."
"It isn't."
"But I do know how hard it is to be the one left behind. I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure you get some answers. Okay?" Rosalind kept staring for another long moment. Then she dropped her purse and laughed, a breathless burst of relief.
Oh, Detective Ryan!"
Before she thought, she had reached across the table and caught my hand.
"I knew there was a reason why you're the perfect person for this case."
I hadn't looked at it this way before, and the thought was warming. "I hope you're right," I said. I gave her hand a squeeze. It was intended to be reassuring, but she suddenly realized what she had done and pulled away in an embarrassed flutter.
"Oh, I didn't mean to..."
"Tell you what," I said. "You and I can talk for a while until Jessica feels ready to explain what she saw. How's that?"
"Jessica? Pet?"
Rosalind touched Jessica's arm. She jumped, eyes wide.
"Do you want to stay here for a bit?"
Jessica thought about this, gazing up into Rosalind's face. Rosalind smiled down at her. Finally, she nodded. I bought coffee for Rosalind and me and a 7-Up for Jessica. Jessica held her glass in both hands and stared as if hypnotized at the bubbles floating upwards, while Rosalind and I talked. Frankly, I hadn't expected to take much pleasure in a teenager's conversation, but Rosalind was an unusual kid. The initial shock of Katie's death had worn off, and for the first time I got a chance to see what she was really like. Outgoing, bubbly, all sparkle and dash, ridiculously bright and articulate. I wondered where the girls like this had been when I was 18. She was naive, but she knew it. She told jokes on herself with such zest and mischief that, in spite of the context and my creeping worry that this level of innocence would get her into trouble one day, and Jessica sitting there watching invisible booglies like a cat, my laughter was real. "What are you going to do when you leave school?" I asked. I was genuinely curious. I couldn't picture this girl in some 9-to-5 office. Rosalind smiled, but a sad little shadow passed across her face. "I'd love to study music. I've been playing the violin since I was 9, and I do a little bit of composing. My teacher says Well, he says I shouldn't have any trouble getting into a good course, but..." She sighed. "It's expensive, and my parents don't really approve. They want me to do a secretarial course." But they had been behind Katie's Royal Ballet School ambitions all the way. In domestic violence, I had seen cases like this where parents choose a favourite or a scapegoat. "I made a bit of a pet of her," Jonathan had said that first day. And siblings grow up in utterly different families. Few of them end well. "You'll find a way," I said. The idea of her as a secretary was ludicrous. What the hell was Devlin thinking? "A scholarship or something. It sounds like you're good." She ducked her head modestly. "Well, last year the National Youth Orchestra performed a sonata I wrote." I didn't believe her, of course. The lie was transparent. Something that size, someone would have mentioned it during the door-to-door. And it went straight to my heart as no sonata ever could have. Because I recognized it. "That's my twin brother. His name's Peter. He's 7 minutes older than me." Children, and Rosalind was little more, don't tell pointless lies unless the reality is too much to bear. For a moment, I almost said as much. "Rosalind, I know something's wrong at home. Tell me. Let me help." But it was too soon. She would have just thrown all her defences up again. It would have undone everything I had managed to do. "Well done," I said. "That's pretty impressive." She laughed a little, embarrassed, glanced up at me under her lashes. "Your friends," she said timidly. "The ones who disappeared. What happened?" "It's a long story," I said. I'd painted myself into this one, and I had no idea how to get out of it. Rosalind's eyes were starting to turn suspicious, and while there was not a chance in hell that I was going to go into the whole knocknery thing, the last thing I wanted was to lose her trust after all this. Jessica, of all people, saved me. She shifted a little in the armchair, stretched out a finger to Rosalind's arm. Rosalind didn't seem to notice. "Jessica?" I said.
"Oh, what is it, sweetheart?"
Rosalind bent towards her.
"Are you ready to tell Detective Ryan about the man?"
Jessica nodded stiffly.
"I saw a man,"
she said, her eyes not on me but on Rosalind.
"He talked to Katie."
My heart rate started to pick up. If I'd been religious, I would have been lighting candles to every saint in the calendar for this. Just one solid lead. "That's great, Jessica. Where was this?"
"On the road, when we were coming back from the shop."
"Just you and Katie.
Yes, we're allowed.
I'm sure you are.
What did he say? He said...
Jessica took a deep breath.
He said, "You're a very good dancer." And Katie said, "Thank you." She likes when people say she's a good dancer.
She looked anxiously up at Rosalind.
"You're doing wonderfully, pet,"
Rosalind said, stroking her hair.
"Keep going."
Jessica nodded. Rosalind touched her glass and Jessica took an obedient sip of her 7-Up.
"Then,"
she said,
"then he said, 'And you're a very pretty girl.' And Katie said, 'Thank you.' She likes that too. And then he said, 'My little girl likes dancing too, but she broke her leg. Do you want to come and see her? It will make her very happy.' And Katie said, 'Not now. We have to go home.' So then we went home."
"You're a pretty girl." These days there are very few men who would say something like that to a 12-year-old. "Do you know who the man was?" I asked. "Had you ever seen him before?" She shook her head.
"What did he look like?"
Silence. A breath.
"Big."
"Big like me? Tall?"
Yeah. "But big like this, too."
She stretched out her arms. The glass wobbled precariously.
"A fat man?"
Jessica giggled, a sharp, nervous sound.
"Yeah."
"What was he wearing?"
A tracksuit, a dark blue one."
She glanced at Rosalind, who nodded encouragingly.
"Shit,"
I thought. My heart was speeding. "What was his hair like?"
"No, he didn't have hair."
I made a quick, fervent mental apology to Damien. Apparently, he hadn't, after all, just been telling us what we wanted to hear.
"Was he old? Young?"
"Like you."
"When did this happen?" Jessica's lips parted, moved soundlessly.
"Huh?"
"When did you and Katie meet the man? Was it just a few days before Katie went away? Or a few weeks? Or a long time ago?" I was trying to be sensitive, but she flinched.
"Katie didn't go away," she said. "Katie got killed."
Her eyes were starting to lose focus. Rosalind shot me a reproachful look. "Yes," I said as gently as I could. "She did. So it's very important for you to try and remember when you saw this man, so we can find out if he's the one who killed her. Can you do that?" Jessica's mouth fell a little open. Her eyes were unreadable, gone. "She told me," Rosalind said softly over her head, "that this happened a week or two before." She swallowed. "She's not sure of the exact date." I nodded. "Thank you so much, Jessica," I said. "You've been very brave. Do you think you would know this man if you saw him again?" Nothing. Not a flicker. The sugar packet hung loosely in her curled fingers.
"I think we should go,"
Rosalind said, looking worriedly from Jessica to her watch. I watched from the window as they walked away down the street. Rosalind's decisive little steps and the delicate sway of her hips, Jessica dragging along behind her by the hand. I looked at the back of Jessica's silky bent head and thought of those old stories where one twin is hurt and the other, miles away, feels the pain. I wondered if there had been a moment during that giggly girls' night at Auntie Vera's when she had made some small, unnoticed sound. If all the answers we wanted were locked away behind the strange, dark gateways of her mind. "You're the perfect person for this case," Rosalind had said to me. And the words were still ringing in my head as I watched her go. Even now I wondered whether subsequent events proved her completely right or utterly and horribly wrong. And what criteria one could possibly use to tell the difference. Ten. Over the next few days I spent practically every waking moment searching for the mystery tracksuit. Seven guys around Knocknaree matched the description, such as it was. Tall, heavily built, 30s, bald or skin-headed. One of them had a minor record left over from his wild youth. Possession of hash, indecent exposure. My heart skipped a beat when I saw that, but all he had done was take a leak down a laneway just as an earnest young cop was passing. Two said they might have been going into the estate on their way home from work at about the time Damien had given us, but they weren't sure. None of them would admit to having talked to Katie. All of them had alibis, more or less, for the night of her death. None of them had a dancing daughter with a broken leg or anything like a motive, as far as I could discover. I got photos and did line-ups for Damien and Jessica, but they both gave the array of photographs the same dazed, hunted look. Damien finally said he didn't think any of them was the man he had seen, while Jessica pointed tentatively to a different picture every time she was asked, and finally turned catatonic on me again. I had a couple of floaters go door to door, asking everyone in the estate whether they had had a visitor matching the description. Nothing. A couple of the alibis were uncorroborated. One guy claimed he had been online till almost 3 in the morning on a biker's forum, discussing the maintenance of classic Kawasaki's. Another said he had been on a date in town, missed the 12:30 night bus and waited for the 2 o'clock one in Supermax. I stuck their photos up on the whiteboard and set about trying to break the alibis. But every time I looked at them, I got the same feeling. A specific and unsettling feeling that I was starting to associate with this whole case. The sensation of another will meeting mine at every turn. Something sly and obstinate, with reasons of its own. Sam was the only one getting anywhere. He was out of the office a lot, interviewing people. County council members, he said, surveyors, farmers, members of Move the Motorway. At our dinners, he was vague about where all this was taking him. "I'll show you in a few days," he said, "when it starts to make sense." I sneaked a glance at his notes once when he went to the bathroom and left them on his desk. Diagrams and shorthand and little sketches in the margins, meticulous and indecipherable. Then on Tuesday, a muggy, petulant, drizzly morning, Cassie and I grimly going through the floaters' door-to-door reports again in case we had missed something, he came in with a big roll of paper, the heavy kind that children use to make Valentine's and Christmas decorations in school. "Right," he said, pulling tape out of his pocket and starting to stick the paper to the wall in our corner of the incident room. "Here's what I've been doing all this time." It was a huge map of Knocknaree, beautifully detailed. Houses, hills, the river, the wood, the keep, all sketched in fine pen and ink with the delicate, flowing precision of a children's book illustrator. It must have taken him hours. Cassie whistled.
"Thank you. Thank you very much," Sam said in a deep Elvis voice, grinning.
We both abandoned our stacks of reports and went over for a closer look. Much of the map had been divided into irregular blocks, shaded in coloured pencil, green, blue, red, a few in yellow. Each block held a tiny, mysterious jumble of abbreviations. SD J Downey G2 11/97 RIS AG IND 8/98. I cocked an interrogative eyebrow at Sam. "I'll explain it now." He bit off another piece of tape and secured the last corner. Cassie and I sat on the edge of the table where we were close enough to see the details.
Okay, see this?
Sam pointed to two parallel dashed lines curving across the map, cutting through the wood and the dig.
That's where the motorway is going to be. The government announced the plans in March of 2000 and bought the land off local farmers over the next year under a compulsory purchase order. Nothing dodgy there.
Well, Cassie said, depending on your point of view.
Shh, I told her. Just look at the pretty picture.
You know what I mean, Sam said. Nothing you wouldn't expect.
Where it gets interesting is the land around the motorway.
That was all agricultural land too up until late 1995. Then, bit by bit, over the next 4 years, it started getting bought up and rezoned from agricultural to industrial and residential.
By clairvoyance who knew where the motorway was going to be 5 years before it was announced, I said.
That's not actually that dodgy either, Sam said.
There was talk about a motorway coming into Dublin from the southwest. I've found newspaper articles, starting in about 1994, when the economic boom kicked in. I talked to a couple of surveyors and they said this was the most obvious route for a motorway because of topography and settlement patterns and a load of other things. I didn't understand the whole of it, but that's what they said. There's no reason why property developers couldn't have done the same thing. Got wind of the motorway and hired surveyors to tell them where it was likely to go?
Neither of us said anything. Sam glanced from me to Cassie and flushed slightly.
I'm not being naive. Yeah, they might have been tipped off by someone in government, but then again, they might not. Either way, it's not something we can prove, and I don't think it means anything to our case.
I tried not to smile. Sam is one of the most efficient detectives on the squad, but it was very sweet somehow how earnest he was about it all.
"Who bought the land?" Cassie asked, relenting.
Sam looked relieved. "A bunch of different companies. Most of them don't exist, not really. They're just holding companies owned by other companies that are owned by other companies. That's what's been taking all my time, trying to find out who actually owns the bloody land.
So far, I've traced each buy back to one of three companies. Global Irish Industries, Futura Property Consultants and Dynamo Development. The blue bits here are global. See, the green ones are Futura and the red are Dynamo.
I'm having a hell of a time finding out who's behind them, though.
Two of them are registered in the Czech Republic, and Futura's in Hungary.
Now that does sound dodgy, Cassie said, by any definition.
Sure, Sam said, but it's most likely tax evasion. We can pass all this on to the revenue, but I don't see how it can have anything to do with our case.
Unless Devlin found out about it and was using it to put pressure on someone, I said.
Cassie looked sceptical. Found out how? And he would have told us.
You never know. He's weird.
You think everyone's weird. First, Mark, I'm only getting to the interesting bit, said Sam.
I made a face at Cassie and turned towards the map before she could make one back.
So, by March of 2000, when the motorway is announced, these three companies own almost all the land around this section of it. But four farmers had held out. Those are the yellow bits. I tracked them down. They're in Louth now. They'd seen what way things were going and they knew these buyers were offering pretty good prices above the going rate for agricultural land. That was why everyone else had taken the money. They talked it over. They're all mates, these four, and decided to hold on to their land and see if they could work out what was going on. When the motorway plans were announced, obviously they copped why these fellas wanted their land so badly, for industrial estates and residential developments, now that the motorway was going to make Knocknarea accessible.
So these lads figured they'd get the land rezoned themselves, double or triple its value overnight. They applied to the county council for rezoning. One of them applied four times and got refused every time. He tapped one of the yellow blocks, half full of tiny calligraphic notes. Cassie and I leaned forward to read them. M. Cleary, App, Rs, Ag, Nd, 5/2000, Ref, 11/2000, Ref, 6/2001, Ref, 1/2002, Ref, SD, M. Cleary, FPC, 8/2002, Rs, Ag, Ind, 10/2002.
This ends Disc Sass Disc.